Good morning. The government stock car was bellowing black smoke this week when the pandemic unemployment payment was linked to travel, with all kinds of questions being asked about just what the state can and cannot question you about at a port or airport. So buckle up, listeners, for swerves, reversals and handbrake turns. On Monday's Live Line, musician Ciarán phoned in after having travelled to Glasgow in May.
And I understand completely that the government's advice was non-essential travel shouldn't take place. But for me, it was essential travel. I hadn't seen my partner in nearly 15 weeks at this stage. So I booked the flight. There was nothing said to me in any terms and conditions of the COVID unemployment payment that if I left the country, that my payment would be in jeopardy. So I booked the flight. I drove up to Dublin. I got on, and as I was waiting at the gate to get on the plane, two plainclothes members of an Garda Síochána approached me and asked me for my licence as they were performing an immigration check. So I got on the plane, went over to Glasgow for 9 days.
I'll just stop you there, just to be clear. So they identified themselves as members of an Garda Síochána. They weren't from the Department of Social Protection.
No, they were wearing the blue rain jackets that you see the Gardaí wearing with the yellow writing on the back to say Garda.
Okay, and you were told that they wanted your driver's license, is it?
My passport or my ID is what they were
looking for. Your ID, and they said they were doing that for immigration purposes.
They were doing an immigration check, is all they said to me. They did not say for what reason, who they were going to be relaying the information to. They didn't say that they were taking information on behalf of the Department of Social Protection. Because to be honest with you, if I really felt that my payment was going to be brought into disrepute or it was going to be taken off me, I probably wouldn't have got on the plane.
But get on the plane he did, and when he returned, his trip had been noted in the great PUP ledger. Drop one, carry the seven, adding up to a big fat zero.
So I flew over on a Thursday, the 7th of May, I believe it was. The payment usually comes in on Tuesday, so the next Tuesday the payment was there. And then it was the following Saturday I returned home, and then the Tuesday that I was back home, there was no money in my account. So I was like, okay, that's a bit strange. But I heard that a few people's money had been stopped for various reasons or that there was delays. So I waited a day or two, still no sign. And I contacted the Department of Social Protection, who informed me that they could see that my money had been stopped. And the reason for it was, and I quote, "We can see that you boarded a Ryanair flight on the 7th of May at 9:30 in the morning. And that's why your money was stopped."
Whoa. Very, very. So that information was somehow inputted on your social protection data?
Correct.
The time of the flight and who you flew with and where you went.
Who I flew with and everything. They knew exactly where I was and when I left the country. And I was not informed at any time that this information was going to be relayed to the Department of Social Protection. And if they had said it to me that it was going to be relayed to the Department of Social Protection, I would have said, here's my return flight. But they didn't care about my return flight. They said, oh, you're gone, your money's been stopped.
Oh, that was my next question. So how did they know when you had returned then? No,
they didn't care. Only if I contacted them, they weren't going to give me that money back. I had to contact Carol Nolan. I had to, seeing as my constituency is Leash Offaly, I contacted Carol Nolan and I contacted Brian Stanley from Sinn Féin, who, in fairness to the two of them, worked well on my behalf. I also sent a letter to the then Minister for the Department of Social Protection, Regina Doherty. Sent her a handwritten letter explaining my situation, but it took 6 weeks for my payments to be reinstated. However, I'm 6 weeks in arrears, so I was 6 weeks without any money, and I had to go back up home to my mother and father, and I was living with them, and only for them, I wouldn't have been able to survive. I had to move home where my sister is with her newborn son and both of my parents, and in the house, and it was mental in the house, but only for them. I don't know where it would have been.
So you didn't have a penny coming in the door.
None, not a thing.
Well, it really kicked off then, were those in receipt of the pandemic unemployment payment being defined as somehow less than and unworthy of the trip abroad, or was the government simply being prudent with the public purse? Later on Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes spoke to People Before Profit TD Richard Boyd Barrett.
These are extraordinary times. Should the government not use every tool at its disposal to try and discourage people from travelling abroad?
Yes, they should. And the starting point for that should be the Department of Foreign Affairs official travel advice should be changed to say all travel that is non-essential should not take place. And then any restrictions or penalties should apply to everybody, or they should apply to nobody. I mean, if you think back, Philip, to when the 2 kilometre rule was applied, if you were outside the 2 kilometres and were stopped by the guards, they didn't say, well, if you're on a PUP payment, you have to abide by this rule and we're going to turn you round. But if you're not on a PUP payment, you can travel 5, 10 or 200 kilometres. There was one rule for everybody in terms of the public health advice. What the government are now doing is applying different rules and restrictions in terms of public health advice on particular cohorts of people. That is fundamentally unjust. It fundamentally undermines the principle that we're all in it together. The reason why there was compliance with public health guidelines, fantastic compliance, and a lot of hardship suffered by people, complying with the public health guidance was because people said we're all in it together. We're all going to be treated the same. We're all going to suffer the same hardships. The government are fundamentally undermining that principle in what they're doing here.
All of this piled on the pressure for the government. And on Wednesday, the News at One brought us this.
People on the pandemic unemployment payment who travel to green list countries will continue to receive their payments. The Minister for Social Protection, Heather Humphreys, has told the Doyle that the government could have communicated more effectively.
Ooh, do you think? All of which brings us rather neatly to this interview Ray conducted with Rutger Bregman, author of Humankind, A Hopeful History.
We humans, we tend to become the stories that we tell ourselves. Stories are never just stories. They can become self-fulfilling prophecies. And this is also true for our view of human nature. What we assume in other people is what we get out of them. For centuries, we've been telling ourselves quite cynical stories about ourselves. And so we've designed our whole society around that story. You know, we've got institutions that continuously assume the worst in each and every one of us. You know, think about how we've organized our democracy or our workplaces or our schools. Yes. Very often, it starts with the assumption that people are just selfish. And my book is an argument that we can turn that around.
It's very hopeful, very hopeful argument. But we see it every day here. Even there's a row going on at the minute, and you know this thing that people will not work to get social welfare money. And like I would believe that most people want to work, and given the opportunity, they will. They won't sit at home.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, our politicians feed into that belief that they won't. That people will skive and they'll live off the state.
And yeah.
That, yeah.
This is another troublesome dynamic, I think, especially with career politicians. Psychologists have long known that power tends to corrupt. And so when elites think about other people or think about their citizens or those they are meant to govern, then they look in the mirror and they assume that most people would behave like they would. Right. But that's not the case.
I shouldn't laugh because it's quite serious. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a dark irony. But that is, I think, a dynamic that you see play out all the time, is that you have this cynicism at the top that the elites have when they think about the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, most people are decent. Power corrupts, but most people are pretty decent.
Yeah.
Rutger Bregman with Ray Darcy. So decency may well rule most of the time anyway. But as a group of elite politicians in government, our shiny new coalition isn't exactly all for one and one for all. More a case of every man for himself. Here's public affairs consultant Gerard Howlin with Sarah McInerney with a softly spoken and kind of damning end of term report.
Across the board, this thing is not meshed together.
Mm.
Certainly the Greens and Fianna Fáil, maybe they have things to learn. But the three parties together are three silos. There isn't a sense of one government. And they will hang together or they will hang separately.
And is that, you reckon, is that a deliberate approach that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael perhaps in particular, maybe the Greens as well, are deliberately trying to hold on to their separate identities within government and as a result aren't working together?
They're doing that, Sarah, literally for dear life. And that is a consequence of the construct of this government. They are not going to go back to the people at any time with a shared identity and a shared message. They will eventually break apart to go separately and in a very competitive way.
Sure, and you expect to see that as you approach a general election.
You do, but if
but
you go
back... not at the beginning of a potential five-year term.
Indeed, but even if you go to the end of previous coalitions, while there was certainly competition between the parties in government, there was also a shared sense of joint achievement and some degree of camaraderie. I don't see the basis of that in this government at all.
And that was all before Today with Sarah McInerney brought us these testy exchanges from the Dáil floor on Thursday night. The issue was Dáil speaking time rules, a serious matter to be sure. But things got very hot and heavy.
You know, I'm embarrassed to be a member of this chamber tonight, quite frankly, because of the behaviour of what I've seen from some of the parties here.
Thank you.
I want people at home to listen to the number of times I'm going to be interrupted when I just try to say a few words in this chamber because of the arrogance and nastiness and abusiveness of the smaller parties and the far left parties in this House, which is to try to dominate this chamber. And any time anyone from government stands up, any time any minister tries to speak, any backbencher tries to make a point, you shout us down. In the same way you bully people online,
day in and day out,
you try to bully people in the chamber here because they come from a larger party or from a government party.
This is not only going to create the rancour we're seeing tonight. Every single day this is going to happen because of what they're doing here tonight.
One of the major elements of accountability is the ability of opposition parties, especially smaller ones, who are operating on fresh air in most cases, to be able to hold the government to account. Pushing our voices into the graveyard shift.
The same people want to deny up to 50 government TDs
of
5 7-minute slots in 3.5 hours. That's what this is about. They should be absolutely ashamed of themselves. It's a disgrace. You're an absolute disgrace. You are the ones who are trying to gag fellow TDs. We were all elected here by the people of our constituencies.
Deputy Griffin from Kerry.
Thank you.
Is he the new bully? He's going to bully us. They might silence us here, but they won't silence the people out there. They're outraged at what's going on in this house and a shambolic bill being passed here this evening.
Could you allow the last Kian Corley to speak, please? Could you allow the last Kian Corley to speak?
It's very late and we're tired.
Ooh, diddum suspiog all round needed there. Overtired and overstimulated. But no mind, because they're off on their lay in the Sarah.
Sorry, what? But hasn't the Dáil sat for like the lowest number of days in the history of the state? Yes, yes, they are. So how are they going on August holidays? Well, I suppose if you look at how it's been going for Mr. Micheál and Dr. Leo, maybe it's best they take a bit of a holiday, you know. Holy Mother of Harleys. It's only been a month, has it? It's only been a month. They've had U-turns, we've had sackings, people literally falling asleep, rogue announcements, and the whole, how best is it? The two popes thing. If there was a film, it would be, well, that's been taken, hasn't it? The two popes. And then you have the Taoiseach keeping the perks of being Taoiseach, and a minister keeping the perks of being Taoiseach, and a Taoiseach who doesn't seem to be very perky, does he? This kind of Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil marriage looks like it's going to have the lifespan of a rich tea biscuit left out in the rain. And don't forget the Greens, which is going to be their slogan in the next election. Don't forget the Greens. So anyway, don't worry, they're off on their holidays, everything is under control, and they'll be back just in time for another pay rise. Yeah, it's actually true. 2% pay hike on October. Nice work if you don't have to do it.
But back to Gerard Howlin for this frankly terrifying prediction for August.
I would warn them about the month of August, by the way. I was an acting government press secretary for several years over the month of August. It is a dangerous, treacherous time. There are open microphones with all over studios in this country with not enough to do in terms of real news. And if there's some faux pas or slip up, it will become not a story of a day, but for a week.
Treacherous microphones tripping up unsuspecting politicians. How very dare you, sir? But vengeance, surveillance and political instability played out in the very modern adaptation for the drama on One this week. Hamlet, Prince of Derry, was adapted by Colin Murphy and directed by Conall Morrison with Stage Beyond Theatre Company, which features adults with learning disabilities. And they were acting from home with the voices recorded remotely during lockdown. No mean feat. Have a listen to this.
The Court of Derry met for the first time today since it was prorogued following the death of King Hamlet. King Claudius paid tribute to his brother, the late king.
The memory of King Hamlet is still very raw.
Oh, villain.
So I have married Gertrude to heal the sore.
Hush, Hamlet.
King Claudius thanked the people of Derry for their good wishes upon his marriage to his late brother's widow, Queen Gertrude. Her son, Prince Hamlet, was not in attendance, and a video he posted online last night has led to some speculation about his mental health. King Claudius said he intended to build on the legacy of King Hamlet and that his administration would combine change with continuity.
Smiling, damn it, villain.
My Lord Hamlet.
My phone. I'll tweet this. See how it goes down. That one may smile and smile and be a villain. At least I'm sure it may be so in Derry.
And this drama brought us Twitter postings, viral videos, gamers fighting to the death, and of course, this.
Recording.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, this a consummation devoutly to be wished.
Hamlet, Prince of Derry, the drama on One, a cracker of a listen. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Yesterday, Oliver Callan chatted to Roddy Doyle about those heady, heady days of Italia 90.
The scenes of the homecoming after, you know, Ewan's glorious defeat in a way, it was kind of approaching mania, wasn't it?
It was unbelievable. I mean, I was on O'Connell Bridge. I lived on Abbey Street at the time and I spent literally hours on O'Connell Bridge waiting for the buses to come down O'Connell Street. And it looked visually as if they were being carried. Yeah. You know, carried by the crowd up along, gradually along the street. I've never seen crowds like it. Yeah. I haven't since. It was just extraordinary, and people were hanging from everything. I believe some of the men on the buses were actually quite frightened that somebody was going to get injured.
That's right.
But from where I was, it was just unbelievable. When the buses actually passed, it was a bit of a letdown. It was just a gang of lads and blazers. Waving and looking drunk.
You expect something supernatural to happen, don't
just
you?
Just a little bit. The wheels were actually on the tarmac and they were going very slowly. But I had this notion that it was like two very colourful, very packed coffins being carried down O'Connell Street.
I mean, it was pretty pride, wasn't it? And
it was brilliant.
The lads represent diaspora. Do you think we've never really had a moment since then like that?
Do you know, it might sound a bit weird, but I think, yeah, in terms of cause for celebration, yeah, possibly we haven't had a moment like it since. Mm. I can't think of any. And it was a moment that seemed to linger, actually. I do think there's a certain truth that we were never quite the same again. I think, it's hard to quantify. It's hard, there's no statistic will ever prove it or disprove it, but it just felt that way. But in a certain way, I think this might sound daft, but I felt that around about March of this year, where there was a level of unity, March and April, a level of unity and a level of we're in this together,
yeah,
a sense of that here, which seemed to be absent in other places where they speak the English language.
Yes, yeah.
And I felt it was in a quiet way, a little bit similar.
There was certainly something in the air, that's for sure. That was Roddy Doyle with Oliver Callan yesterday. And later that evening, the death was announced of Alan Parker, who had directed that Roddy Doyle classic, The Commitments, and of course, Angela's Ashes. Be very gently twerking to that one. That was Mick Delahunty's orchestra from June 1948 in Clonmel, unearthed from the archives on Bowman on Sunday. And according to John Bowman, you might not even be here were it not for that sweet sound.
Some younger listeners may not know his name, some others may have forgotten it, but it seems to me probable that multiple thousands of such listeners should well consider whether they don't owe their very existence to Mick Delahunty. Might it not have been the case that his phenomenal popularity over so many decades provided the occasions when their own parents or even grandparents came to meet, to dance together to his music? He was, after all, playing at what are now known as the ballrooms of romance.
Ooh, the glance and then the dance. But just who got to cross the floor and ask for the hand? Well, here is Mick Delahunty in conversation with Kieran Sheedy from 1976.
The lady's choice, they'd have to have one of those or two every night. But then you got the awkward fella that took Humbridge and some of the lads would dance with his girl, and there might be just that little bit of a tiff.
What about the various customs, Mick, at the dances? You'd often see the girls all on one side and the fellas at the other side. Was this a pattern that you observed?
Yes, it happened in several towns in different parts of the country. And I think it really originated from the Mass on Sunday. In some parishes now, you'll have the men on one side and the women on the other. It doesn't happen at home in our town, lots of others, but in certain places it does. And they take that into the dance hall with them. I have that kind of a feeling. All the men will sit on one side and the girls will sit on the other side in the dance hall. But the job is then to get them together. You'll have to be fiddling with the lights and try and make the lights a bit dim. And if there's no dimmers on them while you're in trouble, you have to work something else. Try to crack a joke and get them to get close together. We always got them moving, but it took a long time. It's a bit of a strain, you know.
Does this still hold to the present day?
No, that's gone out a good while now, I think. I haven't seen it for years now.
Mick Delahunty on the ballrooms of romance as heard on Bowman on Sunday. But one man stepping off the dance floor was writer John Boyne. He spoke to Brendan O'Connor last Saturday about his new book, A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom. But he also talked about being bruised in affairs of the heart.
I don't know. I feel like right now in my life, maybe I'll be sitting here with you in 2 years' time and I'll be engaged to be married. You know, it can change day by day. But just right now, I feel happy to kind of let that part of life just sit on one side. I've spent the last few years trying to heal myself, and I want to be happy in myself. Life is short, and I don't think everybody always has to build their life about, you know, that you're successful if you have somebody to share it with. You know, that's not the way it works for everybody. And I don't think it makes you a failure if you haven't been lucky enough to have that. Yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, if Will Young knocked on my door this afternoon and said, you know, let's go off together, I wouldn't even pack the bag, I would just go. But I don't think it necessarily has to be the be-all and end-all of everything in life.
And Boyne talked about having gotten a lot of flack online for writing about trans issues in his book, My Brother's Name is Jessica, and the vitriol he experienced from online trolls.
If you want to criticise a writer for his or her book, I don't think getting online and saying you are a monster and you're such a monster that I think you should die.
Did you take any of that seriously?
Brendan, I did. I mean, I didn't actually think anybody was going to kill me, but I did take it seriously. If it's coming endlessly, all day, every day, for a period of time, and of course it's never somebody like sort of like at Brendan O'Connor or something. It's always like at, you know, Princess Pink Shoes 1739 with a Japanese manga anime as the profile picture. So it's not even somebody with the courage of their convictions who will say these things. It's, you know, people who don't know me, who know nothing about me, who have not read my work, who know nothing about what I think or what I feel, and they feel that they present themselves as being compassionate. You know, they put their pronouns in their Twitter biogs in order to say how decent and kind and compassionate they are. And then they issue rape threats to J.K. Rowling, or they issue death threats to me. If that's kindness, if that's compassion, you know, then I clearly don't have it.
Not surprisingly, he had strong feelings about cancel culture.
I think everybody has the right to hold an opinion, to express that opinion, and to be debated about that opinion. Who elects anybody to say this is wrong think, this is, you know, you are holding an unacceptable opinion, this is, you know, who decides what is right and wrong in that sense? I find it very strange. I find the cancel culture online is almost always pointed towards women. It is almost always pointed towards shouting down women and not allowing them to express opinions. And it is usually, if not 99% of the time, shouted by men. And that I find very disturbing. People are allowed to hold opinions, and then you can debate them, and you can tell them, you can prove to them why they are wrong. You know, the idea now, and of course, a lot of the time, the witch finders, the witch hunters online are then, after they supposedly cancel somebody, they themselves get cancelled. I think it was Taylor Swift who said, you know, we're not, people aren't TV shows. You know, you can't cancel them. It's a disgusting way to look at humanity.
Writer John Boyne with Brendan O'Connor last Saturday. This week saw Normal People, a.k.a. The Chain, nominated for 4 Emmys. On Arena, Sean Rock spoke to producer Ed Gainey and director Lenny Abrahamson, and he asked Lenny about the particular episode which had earned him his nomination for Best Director.
What was it about that episode that made you think, this is the one I want to put forward?
There's a lot of range in it, tonally and emotionally. And it's this episode where they get back together again, having met again in college. And there's a scene I just particularly like in the middle of it where Connell apologizes finally for how he behaved in Sligo. And it's a scene that feels like it's as good as it could have been. And that's probably the main reason.
Well, actually, you know, I have that very clip in front of me right now. You know. Let's have a listen to it. For those who know the show, yeah, they'll know that Connell didn't invite Marianne to the Debs and that has been a major bone of contention for quite a time.
Did you ever think about asking me to the Debs? I know it's such a stupid thing, but I'm curious whether you thought about it.
To be honest, no. Yeah, I wish that I did. Would you suggest? I'm really sorry. Apparently everybody knew about us anyway.
Everyone knew what?
That we were seeing each other.
I didn't tell anyone, Connell, I swear to
God. I know, that's not what I mean. I mean, my point is that even if you had told people, it wouldn't have mattered.
Were they horrible about it?
No. Believe it or not, no one even cared.
And there you go, Emmy nominated. You know, if I shouted at the television when he didn't ask her to the Debs, Lenny Abrahamson, I shouted even louder when he gave that apology. I wanted to beat him around the ears.
Yeah, it did evoke a lot of strong emotions in people. Yeah, he came in for some criticism, all right.
Oh, Connell, you made us sweat for it. And what about the rig out, though, for the red carpet?
Hazmat tuxedos or something like that.
Lenny Abrahamson with Sean Rocks on Arena. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It's COVID-19 time, because as much as we might want to stick our fingers in our ears and hum, it's all over, it's really not. Tuesday saw 40 new cases of the virus, the highest figure in 42 days. Environment and science correspondent George Lee went through the numbers on the News at 1 on Wednesday. And bear in mind, these numbers reflect weekend reporting.
Since the start of this pandemic, the median age of those infected by COVID-19, the over 25,000 of them, the median age, the one in the middle, 50% below and 50% above this number, was 48 years. On Monday, they were saying over the two-week period to Monday, the median age of the new cases was 37, significantly younger. Yesterday, they're saying the median age was 33. It's getting younger and younger.
So younger and younger, and on Thursday we had a spike of 85 cases, many of them centred around a dog food factory in Naas. Acting Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ronan Glynn spoke to Rachel English on Morning Ireland yesterday.
How worried are you about these new cases?
Well, of course, any increase in cases like this is a cause for concern, and obviously we're watching it very closely. But it's not time for a knee-jerk reaction at this point. We're hopeful that what we're seeing, in fact, is evidence that our contact tracing system is working really, really well. So this is a system that, whilst it was always there for other infectious diseases, has obviously been made much more robust over recent months. And so the aim of that system is to detect cases in clusters very rapidly and to break chains of transmission. And so we know over the past week that there have been a number of clusters. And what we're hopeful of is that the numbers yesterday reflect the rapid response to those clusters, the rapid testing of hundreds of contacts associated with those clusters, and the identification and isolation of cases within those clusters.
And how significant was it that many of these people were living in direct provision?
The basic public health messages that we give to everyone do apply to everyone, regardless of the setting. It's about washing hands. It's about ensuring that if you have any symptoms or if you have any concerns at all, that you immediately isolate and come forward for testing. But yes, there, of course, where groups of people live together, there will be a greater risk that if the virus gets in there, that it will spread, unfortunately. And so measures have to be taken. And my understanding is that all of the measures that need to be taken are being taken. We've learned an awful lot over the past number of months about this disease, how to control this disease. We know how to deal with it. We know, as a population, we've learned how to live with it. And I am hopeful that the blip, what is hopefully a blip last night, will serve as a reminder to us all to double down on efforts as we head into this weekend, rather than being a signifier of something more significant as we're seeing across Europe.
Dr. Ronan Glynn on Morning Ireland yesterday. But what hope might we have for a vaccine? Well, scroll back to Tuesday when Rachel spoke to Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO.
How far away is a vaccine?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question. There are candidate vaccines now all over the world, more than 100 of them. And it's actually wonderful to see that huge amount of scientific research being done. A vaccine, though, is not a sort of guarantee. You can develop a product that you hope will enable people to be immune against infection by the virus. But then you have to test it to check that that immunity applies to everybody, and you have to be sure that the vaccine is safe. We've got a lot of people who are very nervous about vaccination all over the world, so safety is paramount. Now, that testing work takes time, and you can't rush it. Some manufacturers are saying that they're into what we call phase three trials. That's great news. But I think to have a proven vaccine is still going to take us some months, and we won't have one till next year. But then the real issue is, how do you build up the manufacturing capacity and make sure that everybody in the world can have it? And for that, I think it's 2.5 years.
Ooh, that is not what you want to hear. Oh well, that was Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO. Well, over on Mooney Goes Wild, Professor Emma Teeling of the UCD School of Biology and Environmental Science thought the recent discovery of the genetic blueprints for 6 of the world's bats might just provide a clue. For you will recall it was in bats that this virus first occurred. Here's Richard Collins.
Emma, I am totally at sea when it comes to this COVID and bats. On the one hand, bats are said to be a source of this awful thing. And on the other hand, they're supposed to be great at dealing with viruses. How can they have it both ways?
It's a very interesting question that you've asked me, Richard. It's argued that bats have evolved this very unique immune system that allows them to tolerate a lot of viruses. Bats don't seem to suffer the same symptoms when they're infected with the virus like we do and like other mammals do. So the reason why they've argued that they're the cause is because the most similar virus that we have ever found that we know about was found in these bats. But also, potentially the reason why they can have such a high diversity of these viruses is because they've evolved mechanisms to tolerate and live with them. So the bats potentially were somewhere involved in the path that led to this COVID-19, but also they potentially hold novel ways to treat it.
Ooh, dare we hope. Tell us more.
So when you look at how bats progress in terms of an infection, what you have to know is, when do you give the antiviral? When then do you give the anti-inflammatory? What time points in the infection should you give these treatments? The bats have evolved this natural solution already. So by studying how it progresses in bats, we get a much better idea of what we can do. But then the other thing is that we were able to identify these orthologous genes. So the genes that we know are different in the bat immune system, we also have a version of these genes. And what we're very interested in is looking at the expression. So potentially you can give us drugs to knock out some of the genes that are causing this high inflammatory response and causes us to actually have these cytokine storms and makes the outcome of infection quite bad. Potentially we can go and look at what the bats have evolved, find the genes, find the bat pathways, and then mimic the expression of our genes to match that with drugs. We can do this.
And Richard, ever questioning, but perhaps reflecting what we're all biting our nails about, asked this.
You sound optimistic. You sound hopeful. Are you?
I'm really, really hopeful. There was this term that was used in Science magazine. It's called the wilding of immunology. With all the new technologies, we can now look to nature to try and find alternative and novel ways for us to be able to treat diseases. We've got to think outside the box. We've got to think inside the bat. And these genomes are the tools that can allow us to do it now. This pandemic, this zoonotic disease, a disease hopping from a different species into us somehow. COVID-19 is now a human disease. But the thing about it is, it's not the first time that a virus hopped out of a species into humans and caused a devastating effect. HIV, that's a zoonotic disease. The flu, that's a zoonotic disease. And there's potentially lots more out there. And so really what we have to do is we have to think of novel ways to treat this. And we also need to treat our environment and our interactions with our fellow species with a bit more respect, because we aren't that invincible.
Professor Emma Teeling of the UCD School of Biology and Environmental Science has heard on Mooney Goes Wild. Well, on Tuesday, the government brought us their plans for schools to reopen. And while beleaguered parents will welcome this and very possibly their homeschooled offspring, this is how a certain world-weary Ray summed it up.
So 375 million and there's pods and bubbles and there's bubbles and buses. And then when you arrive, you go into another bubble. And then when you're in the classroom, you go to a pod. And they may be using local halls and they've 4 weeks to do it.
God, you'd be tired just listening to him. But with 4,000 schools, 1 million pupils and 100,000 staff, there are a lot of variables. I suspect August may be a long month. So let's distract ourselves by dropping a few superstar names.
Britney Spears, One Direction, John Legend. I've just been Grammy nominated with John Legend this year. Martin Garrix, Bebe Rexha, Niall Horan, Westlife, The Corrs, Avicii, Bebe Rexha, Tiesto.
Oh, some serious names there. That is singer-songwriter Ruth Ann. And she spoke to Des on the island on Thursday. And she'd moved to LA at 17 and got her big break 2 years later when she co-wrote the hit Too Little, Too Late.
19 seems incredibly young to become a hit songwriter.
It is. It is young. The guy that I wrote it with, Billy Steinberg, he also wrote Like
a
Virgin.
He's a legendary figure, yeah.
Legendary, yeah. True Colors, Like a Virgin, it's because of him that this, I was even involved in this song. Mm. But he had his first hit at 30. So I remember we sat together at an award show. We won an ASCAP award for it, Too Little Too Late. And he said to me, you know, it took me 12 years to get to this moment. I was 30 when I had my first hit. You're 19. Yeah. So you have almost a great head start, because most people work as songwriters for a long time. So it was a lot of pressure for a 19-year-old, because of course when you have one, everybody goes, okay, when are you gonna have your next?
The difficult second one, yeah.
Yeah, and I definitely went through times where it hasn't all been, you know, hit, 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 hit. I've had times where it's a roller coaster. The music industry is a roller coaster. And the main thing that I learned is to just keep it about making the best music possible. So whenever I'm in a room with someone, I'm just always trying to write the best song, because I believe that great songs will have their day. And sometimes I've written songs and it's taken 2 or 3 years for them to come out and be a hit. Sometimes I've written songs that I thought would be a hit and weren't. But thankfully, I've been incredibly fortunate with the songs that I've been a part of, really, you know, being loved by the public and having these songs that people know and being part of people's musical history. Like, it is really amazing that sometimes when I was in the room with John Legend, for instance, I have to pretend like I'm all cool, but I was massively, you know, in this awe. Is someone who I looked up to,
yeah,
and it was inspired by, and you have to kind of act like you're cool as a cucumber.
Yeah.
But you do kind of go, I am just from Donegal and I'm sitting here with John Legend and now I'm nominated for a Grammy with John Legend. Like, it is crazy to me, like, what's happened, but yeah. It all stems from just my love of music. Like, I've never been about money first. I've never been about fame. It's always been like just wanting to create as good of a songs as the songs that I grew up listening to. Like, wanting to create something that stands the test of time like that is always what I've been about.
Ruth Ann with Des. Now, if you have a hankering for a cheese board this weekend, for it is the bank holiday, treat yourself. Think ricotta rather than easy single. Be like Monco McGann on the Almanac of Ireland. And he wanted to know this of Ireland's high kings and 5th century monks.
What did they eat?
I'm imagining nuts and berries, or else great feasting in the style of Game of Thrones, where battle-weary heroes gorge themselves on meat. Wooden tables heaving under the heft of roasted pigs or cattle. But no. Martin tells me our ancestors ate something called bonvia, or white meats.
That's like chicken and fish, is it?
No. White meats are basically various forms of milk, which is basically our butter, our curds, like we have today, and sort of ricotta and that sort of thing. But also we had hard cheeses as well.
Hang on a second. Ricotta in early Ireland? How can something we associate with sun-kissed Sicily have existed in pre-famine Ireland?
Well, to answer this, let's hear more from Máirtín Mac an Iomaire, who lectures at DIT. And he takes us back 6,000 years to the start of farming in Mayo, of course.
We can see that from the excavation that has been done down in North Mayo, in the Cage of Fields, that we have the earliest evidence of organised farming in Western Europe.
The Cade of Fields is an archaeological site on the North Mayo coast. And it's where a local school teacher, Patrick Caulfield, and later his son, Seamus, discovered what looked like human-made walls underneath a blanket bog. These weren't typical house walls. They were the type of walls used to create small fields, which would contain cattle. And this led the archaeologists to conclude that these were dairy farmers.
If it was just for meat, you wouldn't need small walls. You could just let them out because you only need to bring them back when you're killing them. Whereas the idea of dairy farming is that you need to milk them twice a day, so it all needs to be organised and structured.
And this is where cheeses come into our story. You see, along with grains and occasionally meat, milk remained at the heart of the early Irish diet for thousands of years. The milk was drunk and also churned into butter. And then the byproducts were fermented and made into things like ricotta. There were even varieties of hard cheeses that can be likened to cheddar or parmesan. What were called milk products that needed long chewing and those that needed slow chewing. In fact, a hard cheese called tannig played a crucial role in Ireland's epic saga, the Táinbó Cúilne. The main protagonist, Queen Maeve, was killed by a piece of it flung from a sling by her nephew, Furabud.
Who knew cheese had such a lineage? That was the Almanac of Ireland with Máinco McGann. Fascinating stuff. And Mayo was on Oliver Callum's mind.
I might make a trip to Mayo and have my eye on it.
Yeah, we might let you in. But you better not read out text like this.
Noel is on the text. I've a great suggestion for Mayo. Practice GAA more. Ooh, guess where Noel is from. Yeah, Dublin.
Ooh, well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And Mayo, Dublin, it's on. No girl can tell me about my mother. 16 shot, we go longer than a ladder. Them nothing talk, but they real done that. Put body in a pot, them a